Welcome to Notes from the Western Edge, a monthly half-hour on-demand webcast featuring musicians who create on the edges of jazz, new music, electronics, and a broad expanse of sonic spaces in between. Last month, I promised some surprises for issue number 10 in October. Well, here they are. Kirsch Kalay, that's right, his name is not pronounced Karsh Kale, has been busy creating a new edge between the sounds of his hometown of Brooklyn, New York, and the sounds of his heritage, the country of India. I caught up with him in July at the Getty Center, where he was performing with his band that evening on a program called Global Delights, one of the Getty's free outdoor summer sessions concert events. Michael Steffens has been creating his own edge as well, this one between his Jewish heritage, his adopted life as a Buddhist, and the jazz that has infused his soul since his childhood in Miami. I spoke with him in a comfortable Pasadena bungalow just before he moved back east to 2 acres of birch forest in the Pocono Mountains. I hope you enjoy the show. Some have called Kirsch Kalay's music lounge. Some call it electronica. Others have called it Asian underground or even Asian massive. Since 2001, Six Degrees Records has released 7 albums by Kalay, including this one, Liberation, in 2003. Six Degrees defines Asian massive as the meeting place where modern urban culture weaves seamlessly with ancient South Asian traditions. That sounds good to me, as long as South Asian isn't confused with South Indian, because as we'll hear later, South Indian music and North Indian music are two related but different things. Kirsch Kalay was born in England to parents from Bombay, India, who moved to New York City in the 1970s when Kirsch was 4. Around the house, he heard an extraordinarily wide range of music from a rather unlikely grouping of sources.
Well, my father was very much into Indian classical music, and of course, being away from their homeland, they were very much into film music, which is always the popular music of the time, so especially film music, Indian film music from the 60s and the 70s, and which was much more compositional-based back then. It was much more orchestrated music, where it's much more like just straight pop music now. So I was listening to a lot of that, and then my father was also playing a lot of the Beatles and things like Bing Crosby and, you know, just stuff that he was listening to in college. So that was really my first introduction into music. So those sounds kind of mixing together in my home and in and around our environment was really, that was the place where I first started to put these things together.
Kirsch started putting things together at a very young age.
I first sat down in front of the tablas when I was 3 years old. And I had a kind of a natural inclination to the instrument. It was something where I was able to translate, not only with tabla, but with drums as well. Whereas I was able to kind of translate what I was hearing right away. And then I started studying with a teacher in India. I would go there with my family every year for a month. And then I actually spent a little bit of time there and studied with a teacher. But then I realized very quickly that my path was heading somewhere different, and it wasn't about playing classical music anymore. It was about drawing from classical music and drawing influence from Indian classical music. And I mean, I was very much I would be going to concerts all the time, and I was very much influenced by a lot of the different artists, but I was also kind of pushed away from the concept of you have to do this in this particular manner, this style, this gharana, and you can't do anything else, so you got to stop listening to Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and stuff. So that kind of, you know, that was where I had to split off from the tradition of it, and it became my own.
Before going any further, I should say that traditionally, the tablas that Kalay is talking about are a set of 2 hand drums played in North Indian classical music. With tabla master Zakir Hussain, maverick bassist and producer Bill Laswell, along with a few others, Calais helped to forge a new amalgamation of styles, sounds, and textures like the one you're hearing right now. This piece is appropriately entitled Milan, the Meeting of Two Rivers. Joining Hussein on tablas, Laswell on bass, and Calais on drum kit, drum programming, beat manipulation, keyboards, and atmospherics, is Ajay Prasanna on bamboo flute, along with the source of many a Bollywood film score, the Madras Chamber Orchestra. Quite an amalgamation indeed. Sometimes Calais' music has more of an Indian flavor, and other times, it's a little more like Brooklyn.
I have a dream that sits side by side
with young guns that blast the siege to genocide.
From the beginning we ride, cause we told
the journey got strange though,
when we rode through
changes on right and
switch sides fight.
From loads that's got might to loads that's right within,
and more mighty is my ballpoint than an M16.
But if I have to, I'ma blast to manifest my dream.
The traditions of music in India go back a long, long way, in two major streams, Carnatic in the south of India and Hindustani in the north. Calais grew up hearing and playing Hindustani music, but later discovered Carnatic music as well. In both traditions, learning to play well takes many, many years of strict training with a guru who ingrains all of the musical rules into your musical mind, body, and spirit. For Calais, living in Brooklyn, he decided early on that his path was to be a different one.
For me, I realized right away when I was younger that it has to do with my environment, and it doesn't make sense for me to adhere to a school that doesn't really say anything about where I was coming from. And I was coming from New York, you know, first and foremost, so the tabla had to make sense for me in New York City. And it couldn't be Punjab Gharana or Farrukhabad Gharana, it had to be Brooklyn Gharana for me, you know.
In other words, for Calais, his Gharana, or community of musicians, had to be centered on Brooklyn, where he grew up, but it could still reflect the heritage of his ancestors.
Electricity is surging through my body.
On his latest album, Broken English, Calais' song, Dancing at Sunset, is a tapestry of influences.
It started as two different pieces, where I had written a very simple guitar progression on acoustic guitar, and I was always singing this line, which I was hearing as it was more of a Carnatic string line, and which I just kind of cataloged as an idea, and I just kind of put it away. And I also had this electronica piece where I had this beat that was just going in four. It was a very simple idea, and a guitar line that was going in six. So it was basically a 6/4 feel, which I really liked. I wanted to build something off of that idea. And then all of a sudden, these two ideas at one point, when I was in India, I was working on these two pieces, and they came together in such an amazing way. And so all of a sudden, I have this Carnatic orchestra playing on top of this heavy dance, almost trance kind of piece with a rock and roll guitar part. It had all of these different stages, and it's the kind of piece where I could sit on an acoustic guitar and play the whole thing. or play with an Indian orchestra and play that song, or be in a club and play it using all electronic instruments and play the same song. So it's kind of lives in all of these different worlds at the same time. And that's what the song is about as well, lyrically. It's kind of about jumping from these different environments and chasing a woman through these environments. That's basically how we put
it
together.
Which much of Indian art is about.
Yes, of course.
Kale and I went on to discuss the emotional range of his music and the relationship with the ancient system of emotions in the arts of India, the nine rasas: joy, sadness, tranquility, nobility, wonder, laughter, fear, anger, and disgust. In classical Indian music, these emotions are tied very specifically to particular pieces of music called ragas, and even relate to the time of day when a raga should be performed. For Kale, the emotional terrain of his music is much more mashed up and complex.
I think, for me, it's definitely about the complexity of the environments. I mean, in Indian music, there's the idea of ras, the idea of capturing a very particular emotion in its pure form. So if it's romance, it's purely romance. And if it's sadness, it's sadness. And if it's anger, it's anger. If it's, and, you know, for me, I mean, our world is too complex to only hear things in their pure form. You know, I don't listen to morning rags in the morning. I listen to them at night. And so in the same way, it's about taking the idea of romance and chaos at the same time, and anger and sadness and happiness at the same time, and madness. And so, I mean, it's all of these different things. So I definitely try and kind of pull from the extremes of these emotions, and then also try and take people on a journey, because it's never about just stay. I'm not trying to create a sad song. I'm trying to pull people from a sad place to a happy place, or pull people from a happy place to a sad place, and always flipping the script on people. That's always what I'm trying to do with the music. And because that's the way my life has been. That's the way life has been for me. It's always been something that's been so turbulent, you know, and sometimes, and so manic. So I definitely try and address that in my music.
Kale has forged a music that could only have been created in our time, in our place. In 1962, Marshall McLuhan used the term global village to describe the world in which we live. More than 40 years later, Kersh Kale is staking out his own territory in that village with a music that unites East and West in ways totally his own.
For me, it's about the big sound. It's about the finding something bigger than myself, you know. For me, I left the pursuit of trying to prove myself as a musician as much as it was about trying to lift this sound up, and so that other people can get influenced by it and take it even further.
Los Angeles for Notes from the Western Edge. I'm Richard Paskey.
If I had a dollar for every time I played at a bar mitzvah and a wedding, I could certainly be driving a Hummer, which I wouldn't drive anyway. My mother once said to me, she said, geez, you have a doctor's degree, but you don't fix anything. I said, yeah, I fix minds, you know. I don't fix minds, I fix my own mind. I try to fix it on being good and being better. So that's where I'm at, you know, just to be, to continue to learn, to do what I tell my students to do, keep an open mind, keep open ears, keep an open heart, open eyes, stay open.
Michael Steffens wears three hats. He's a drummer, he's a poet, and he's a college professor. Sometimes he wears more than one hat at the same time, but on this version of Hava Nagila from his album Om Shalom, it's nothing but the drum hat. For the album as a whole, however, he donned a fourth hat as record producer, bringing together three generations of Miles Davis alumni, Dave Liebman and Benny Maupin on saxophones, and Monyungo Jackson on percussion, along with bassist Scott Colley and himself on drums, into one cookin' ensemble. For Hava Nagila,
I wanted to do something different with it, so Liebman and I, being the only two Jews in the band, we decided we would do Hava Nagila soprano sax and drums, and we did two takes. And Liebman just ate me up. He made me play things I would not have. And I wrote an arrangement for it, basically. And we followed it pretty closely, but he just absolutely ate it up and spit it out. And it's unlike anything you've ever heard. It's a real fast tempo. It was very exciting. And it was a Liebman all the way, you know, just Liebman me. Epiphany in college, because I was a Buddy Rich clone, and the epiphany I had is I played a session when I was at the Mobile Jazz Festival after hours, and the bass player put his bass down and walked away while I was playing. He really did. And then another drummer came, and he was accompanying a singer. He wasn't part of a big band or a competition. Guy from New York, and he played about half as much as I played, and he played 10 times better. He really played better. He just locked into the groove. I stayed up all night thinking about that and wondering what it was that I was doing wrong. And then that was when it hit me. You're playing too much. You can say more by playing less.
That epiphany in Mobile is only one of many that Steffens has had along the path of his musical life, since he learned drum rudiments as a youngster in Miami. One thing has been constant, however: his willingness to listen, to learn, as he says, to stay open.
I came up as a parade drummer, and then as a swing drummer, because our influences were Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa, and then some guy at school had a drum head. He was in the drum line. He had a drum head that had people's names on them I never heard of. This is in junior high, actually. Art Blakey, Philly Joe Jones, Max Roach. I didn't know who any of these people were. And I said to this guy, I said, can I move, you got these records, can I come to your house and listen? And he said, sure. And that started it. I mean, I heard that. And then it took me about 10 years to get away from the rudimental, exciting kind of stuff, you know, and into this other more lyrical thing. I heard Philly Joe the first time with Miles Davis, and it blew my head off. It was like, wow, listen to that locomotion in his playing and stuff. The same with Max. Max to me was a tremendous influence in that he taught me how to solo. He taught me about space, and he still does. You know, I listen to those records. He could play a solo. He really knew how to manipulate the silence. And he was the first of his kind, I think, that could do that in terms of being a virtuoso. So that was Max and Philly Joe and Elvin, of course. Later, Elvin and Tony Williams and Jagdy Jeanette. And then my teacher in New York was Joe Chambers, who is the master of color and nuance. So it's been a long and very interesting trip, man, you know.
Stephens told me about his one lesson with Elvin Jones.
Elvin said to me, "Well, what do you want to learn?" In that Elvin way that he had. And I said, "I want to learn to look at the drums and feel good about them." That's what I, and he started laughing, you know. I said, "I want to be able to make the drums rumble from the floor like you do." Well, no one has ever been able to do that. There are people who have come close, but that was Elvin. That was his thing, you know. So, I mean, we talked a lot about rhythm and time and stuff, and it was like a little master class for me. It didn't last an hour, you know, but it was sensational. And we talked about a lot of things. He talked about clean living. You know, of course, he'd been through the ringer. And we talked about the responsibility you have to playing. And it was very inspirational.
In 1976, Stephens finished his PhD in education in Washington, D.C., and embarked on what he calls the ultimate non sequitur. He packed up and moved to Los Angeles, where he became a studio musician, not by design, but by default.
Someone came into a club and heard me play and said, "Can you read music?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Can you read fly specs?" And I swallowed really hard and said, "Yeah, fly specs," meaning, can you read anything? I mean, if he put Stravinsky in front of me, Listwater sold out, I would have had some serious trouble, you know, or certain other things. But and I waited about a month, and I thought, what a cruel joke. And then all of a sudden, a contractor called and said, "You want to come to Warner Brothers?" And I showed up at Warner Brothers. He's a cartage company, deliver my stuff. I didn't know what a cartage company was at the time, delivered musical instruments. And on the date was Harvey Mason. And Harvey was playing percussion. I had no idea Harvey was such a great percussionist, which he is. And it was a revelation. Harvey liked the way I played drums and said, "Would you want to sub for me?" I said, "Sure." So I spent 76, 77, 78, 79, 80 in the studios, in and out. And then I traveled in that span of time with Shirley MacLaine as well. I did the best possible gigs you can do. I did the Academy Awards in 82. I played rehearsal drums. And Shelly Mann did the real gig. But I worked with the dancers and stuff. And it was really amazing. It was wonderful. But I did. I found that I was very unfulfilled. You know, it's just that I got to the point where I got in the studios and I was playing 5, 10, 12 bar cues. And you know, you sit at the snare drum and play zing with a cymbal scrape, and you get paid $350. And I thought, is that all there is?
The epiphany couched in that question led Stephens away from the Hollywood studios to a more fulfilled life as a college professor.
Teaching, there's an aesthetic to that is much akin to playing. You're still communicating with people, and if you do it passionately and honestly and admit your mistakes and continue to grow as a human being, it's all interrelated. So I was teaching English composition courses at a college named Woodbury University. I was there from 86 to 90, 85 to 90 actually. Teaching part-time, helping students. I wasn't a counselor, I was helping students with their educational programs. It was really very fulfilling. And then Pasadena City College called. I mean, a job opened up, and I said, "Sure, no problem, I'll do it." I mean, I accepted, I got an interview and accepted the job, and I loved it. I was there for 16 years. I just resigned, actually, to move back east.
We're listening to Om Shalom, the title track on Stephens' 2005 album that brings together his work as both a musician and a spoken word artist, along with songs from his Jewish heritage. The idea was to
do reconstructions of them in some way that would honor them, but still create and show a lineage, but would also bring them up to date in some way. Also, because I'm a Buddhist in the sense that I'm constantly learning and stumbling and bumbling through Buddhism, which I've been doing for quite a number of years, I saw a lot of similarities between what I was reading in, say, Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was a Talmudic scholar and quite a human being, and reading, say, the Dalai Lama, or reading some of the Zen, Alan Watts, of course, first, you know, that brought it to this country and was one of the people responsible for helping us understand what it is was going on over in Japan and in India. And then reading, of course, Krishnamurti and then reading Pema Chodron and Trungpa and all these other people, you know. And I started to see such similarities between these things that I became what was known affectionately as a Jubu, a Jewish Buddhist or a Judist or whatever you want to call us, I don't know. So I think of myself in that way. And I wanted to bring that together as well.
The album's final track brings together Adon Olam, a traditional Jewish song praising the Lord of the world, with themes from John Coltrane's piece of spiritual awakening, A Love Supreme. This summer, after many years living in California, Stephens relocated to 2 acres of birch forest in the Pocono Mountains, 90 minutes outside of New York City. His plans for the future?
My plans are to keep being better, you know, and to be constantly humbled by what I hear in New York, you know, and be to lend my own identity to any music I play or to any poem I write.
Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time, we'll hold more surprises. See you in November. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge and Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paskey. Until next time, keep listening.